Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording October 6, 2020, we're going to be speaking with retired Vice Admiral Darren Hocko, Canada's former military representative at NATO, who's going to be reflecting on some of his observations about the alliance during his time there. Darren, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity, Dave.
So we're going to talk about a few different things related to NATO operations and NATO strategic management and alliance politics and the current dynamic. And we're doing so because the last job that you retired out of with the Canadian Armed Forces was a NATO posting. So start us off by telling us a little bit about that job and what it entailed, and then what you're back in Canada doing now.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave. I retired after 36 years in the Canadian Armed Forces as a Vice Admiral, and my last job, as you indicated, was a NATO job. I was in Brussels. I was the Canadian military representative to the Military Committee in Permanent Session. And essentially what I did is I represented our CHOD, our Chief of Defense, the Chief of Defense Staff, General Vance, in NATO's Military Committee, which is the most senior military advisory body in the alliance.
And so what advice does that body give, and to whom is that advice given?
So in NATO, you have the North Atlantic Council, which is represented at an ambassadorial level. And that is, given that the alliance is a political military alliance, that political body, the North Atlantic Council, is a session in permanent session chaired by the Secretary General. And it represents the political will of the 30 allied member states. And at a military advice level, the senior military body is the Military Committee in Permanent Session. It's chaired by the chairman of the Military Committee, in this case, Stu Peach, and he chairs representatives from all 30 allies, and we provide military advice at a strategic level on everything from exercises, operations, activities. If you think about the recent reported Russian Federation cyber attack against the OPCW in 2017-18 timeframe, that is an example of the type of activity that occurs that the military committee is providing advice on, and what we would consider doing from a military lens to the political level.
And now you're back home. You've just recently retired from the Canadian Forces and taken up a new position. Tell me a little bit about that before we start talking about some of that operational advice and the exercises that are ongoing right now.
Certainly. So kind of at the 36-year point, I declared success, if you will. I retired from the Canadian Forces. And one of the things that I was interested in doing was finding a place in my post-military work life that I'd be able to continue to contribute to Canada in some meaningful way. And luckily for me, I lined up and had an opportunity with Deloitte Canada, where I'm an executive advisor providing advice to defense, security, and justice portfolios. So I feel there's a really good match of the expertise and experience that I have. I'm able to bring that across to support the problems that defense, security, and justice customers would need to have solved. So I can still continue to work those important problems. Good fit.
Okay. So to reflect back on the job that you recently just came away from, I guess I'll stretch off just sort of at a high level. I wanted to touch on a couple of the things that from your vantage point, from your time in Brussels, that you thought, despite the value of NATO to Canada and the importance of the alliance in Canada's defense and security, that you thought hadn't necessarily been adequately captured in the current discussion, given their significance. You know, what struck you most about NATO from your time there that you think goes underappreciated back home in Canada?
Well, I think if there were three ideas that I would want to have greater emphasis put upon, they would be understanding deterrence, and there's actually a need to understand deterrence, both at an alliance level and from a Canadian point of view. Then I would say, NATO is, but needs to become more of a global diplomatic persona to help manage the contentious hybrid and other types of challenges that face the alliance, which includes Canada. And I think the third thing would be perhaps that there is a process under the NATO defense planning process to consider what capabilities are needed. And that bridges to all allies, including Canada and our own defense policy and what we want, what capabilities we need to have. But there needs to be a look at a deeper level of integration of the kind of capabilities that we have as an alliance and as member states, and how we should be planning together forward. those would be the kind of three ideas that I would kind of put in sequence if I could.
Okay. So if we start with the deterrence piece, expand on that a little bit. What aspects of that do you think are particularly salient right now that we don't necessarily capture? And one thing that the Alliance speaks about at times is the deterrent value of the different exercises that it has underway. And as we're recording this podcast, the most recent one, Dynamic Mariner, has not yet, but is about to soon complete. So where do you see deterrence kind of fitting into the landscape, and how is the Alliance approaching that?
So, yeah, I think you have to start back with a bit of a problem definition of like, how do we deter adversaries and deterrence theory? I think when we think of global deterrence, we really kind of default back from an Alliance point of view to Cold War realities, where it's a pair comparison of the Soviet Union and the Alliance. Now, that might seem like old speak in the context of the global realities of today, because it seems so far in the past. And that actually creates a bit of a challenge, because we, from an Alliance point of view, have only recently, circa 2014, with the illegal annexation of Crimea, started to realize that there is a need to consider deterrence in a very practical, current way. And deterrence theory, simply put, is you have to raise costs on an adversary who wants to try to do something to make it harder for them to do it, or you impose costs as a punishment such that it's not in their interest to do things. And there's ways, if you think of Dynamic Mariner, that you try to achieve that by having ready forces, by demonstrating political resolve, that the societies are ready to act, and you think of the total defense concept of many of the Baltic countries as an example, a manifestation of that political resolve. Then, If I put some points of context, Dave, Alliance command and control is very solid. But when you think of the responsiveness that might be necessary at a given point in time, and we think of really important recent evolutions of the Alliance in response to the 2014 illegal annexation of Crimea, that's things like the enhanced forward presence of the Canadian battle group in Latvia. Well, that's an activity as opposed to a NATO operation. And what that means is that NATO doesn't command and control it. So if there was a problem, if there was a need to bring all those forces that were forward deployed under NATO command and control under SACEUR, there would need to be some important process steps that would take a minimum of a certain number of hours, if not a short number of days, to get to, which could cause problems in the safety and security of our Canadian troops, or that would cause concerns about how they would be employed and how rapidly they could be set up for success. There's aspects of the NATO command structure versus force structure. Who is running it, whether it's an exercise or an activity? And then there are, so I've talked about some command and control challenges. What about the fiscal challenges in relationship to deterrence and what exercises we want to participate in? How well established are our standing naval maritime groups? Are they completely filled with vessels that are capable? And I think the answer is insufficiently consistently. We have a number of nations willing to commit forces to these standing naval maritime groups. We do a fair amount of exercising, which is extremely important. But when we think of deterrence, we think we want to communicate to a potential adversary, whether it be the Russian Federation or other, that we are able to respond, we have the political will to respond, and we will impose costs. We will make it difficult for you to achieve whatever it is that you want to try and achieve. And that kind of brings to the fore the idea of Alliance decision-making challenges. And some allies, I think for very good reasons, have a very sharp perspective about political control of the military at the Alliance level. And I can understand why that would be. And there are other allies who have perhaps a somewhat, they would say they take a more pragmatic approach and have confidence in military commanders to make the right decisions within established guidelines. So all of these dimensions, and we've heard of the Macron reporting in relation to the EU and the value proposition of NATO and comments widely reported, brain dead, et cetera, et cetera. And so when we think of all these things, and then you put a Putin lens on deterrence, and you go, well, how would I Putin consider a Polish national exercise with several other countries also happen to be NATO allies be perceived? Well, I'm not going to look at that as a Polish exercise. I'm going to consider that as a NATO activity. All that to say that we don't actually, and so what would I think about the differences of what we would need to do, Dave, going forward is we if we agree that we need to have an effective deterrence in place, because it's always better to deter than to undo or to fight, then we need to relearn and rethink about what deterrence is in the modern era. It's not a binary thing. It's not about war or not war. It's not about nuclear war and stopping nuclear war. It's a new hybrid reality. There are many tools and levers that we have not been ever accustomed to using, or that we need to increase the nuance of how we use them, either diplomatically in the information sphere, in the military sphere, like what Dynamic Mariner will do for us, and potentially even in the economic sphere. And I'll close with the idea that there is space for NATO and the European Union to coexist here. It is not one versus the other. It is not no overlap of Venn diagram between these two important actors in the European security environment. But I would also argue that other major actors globally, whether we're talking about Iran or China or other, you know, the reach and the consequence that they have now is such that NATO needs and is taking a more global view of things. And the question is, how structured are they to act deliberately in that space?
So to work back through a bunch of those different pieces, starting where you ended off, which was touching on kind of the political level and the understanding of how to approach this. So you started off by framing a couple different kind of either tactical or operational level considerations about the nuts and bolts of how you actually implement. To work back though from where you left off, how much is the issues about implementing deterrence, if you could frame it that way, is it driven by a lack of consensus by the different allies about how to actually conceptualize what the problem is? Is there common understanding and then differences of about how to implement, and then of course the well-known issues about how to resource and those types of things? Or is part of the fundamental problem that there isn't a wide enough consensus within the alliance about how to actually conceptualize one of the key elements of what it's supposed to do, which is to deter adversaries?
You know, to me, you're kind of landing right in the crux of the issue. There is a consensus that's reflected in many of the external communiques, and I would, you know, just confidently say in many of the classified discussions that have occurred in the United States about what the problems are and what the challenges and what the risks from potential adversaries are. What is at issue is the risk versus probability calculus that each ally will take. And fairly, if you're a southern country, you're dealing with concerns in the Mediterranean every day. And if you're Turkey, you're looking at the risk of terrorism that's manifesting itself both inside your borders and on your borders every single day. And so you are looking at irregular migration. You were looking at these varied concerns as not existential, although Turkey would argue existential for their own perspectives, but they would look at them as really consequential and being managed every day and needing to be concerned about every single day. And yes, a war with the Russian Federation or a limited conflict with the Russian Federation is possible. And it would be very severe and concerning, but it is not probable. So let's focus on what we need to deal with right now. And then if you took Estonia's position or any of the Baltic countries or the Polish perspective, and they, while I was in the Canadian Armed Forces, they were in the Soviet Union. That's not that long ago. And so they really do have a defined perspective about what the risks are. And Estonia in 2007 suffered significant cyber attacks. We all look at what the consequences of attacks against Georgia were. We all are aware of the interference from the Russian Federation in a variety of different ways. So they would say, you know, it's not about this binary type of a conflict. It's now this sliding scale of a hybrid engagement or competition that we are in with the Russian Federation. And so it's not this academic thing, Southern allies, it's this practical, real thing that we're also dealing with. And so your ask of me, Dave, is there a lack of consensus? I think the attributes of the two risks are agreed amongst allies. The probability and the consequence of them are a constant source of debate amongst the alliance, which complicates the ability of making consensus-based decisions around attribution, strategic communications, planning, and thus impacting on resource allocation.
And to go a little further on the item that you just mentioned there about recognizing that the alliance now is comprised of, I guess it's trending toward the third of the allies were actually within the former Soviet orbit at one point. Was it your appreciation that when it comes to, you know, recognizing that deterrence is in a large part about communicating what you would do if certain things happened to somebody else? And if you focus on the Russians as the current kind of the primary focus, at least in the immediate sense, do the former Soviet members have different appreciations that differ from some of the other allies, like Canada, as an example, in terms of understanding and appreciating how the Russians would think about different NATO activities or different NATO exercises, preparedness, commanding, putting them in place, rapid reaction forces, that kind of thing? Do you get different views about, you know, how the other side would appreciate doing the same thing if you can get agreement on what to do?
I think there's a pretty, one, we benefit in the alliance from the knowledge that the Czech Republic brings, that the Baltics bring forward, that countries in the Balkans understand from their continuing engagements with Russia and with other, you know, the Moldovan, other near abroad countries that we all deal with. So I think there really is a common understanding of what types of actions that we can take that would have an effect. But what's really interesting is that in discussions, professional discussions with, for example, some of my Polish colleagues and other, what was really clear is that we as an alliance in the midst of the Cold War, we thought we were communicating effectively to the Soviet Union about what NATO was and what we would do and what we stood for. And what was clear is that was not what they thought or heard or believed. And what that means is we have to always have a little bit of cautious skepticism about how clearly we think we can actually communicate to a potential adversary in an oligarchic-like structure as we see power being managed in the Russian Federation, to use that as an example, not to mention other threat actors in the terrorist sphere. That how can we performance measure what they understand from what we're trying to communicate to them? So I think we have a tremendous knowledge about how the Russians used to think and probably still think in the context of the new Russian Federation as compared to the Soviet Union. But at the same point in time, we need to be cautious that we think we know, because I think there's a bit of hubris in there that we just need to recognize.
And as you look at what the current manifested expression of Russian strategic intent and the various forms that that's taking. So you mentioned Crimea, which was a combination of you know, small conventional military tactics and then a whole range of other activities. You have the little green men terminology emerging there and a bunch of other things that have various labels, gray zone or hybrid, et cetera. Do you think that understanding and the creating a good understanding on both sides of a deterrent framework, how much has that or does it still need to evolve to move from more conventional aspects across into this new kind of less clear, more messy sphere of potential conflict or latent conflict with the Russians in particular, but also other people around the world that we would be cognizant of? How much thinking is there still to do and landing on agreement about how to act as you move into these new spheres of activity?
You know, I think what I would do there, Dave, is bridge and kind of address that thrust with like the second idea, that being NATO as a global diplomatic persona. And I don't mean global as in global superpower, but really having a sphere of interest that is naturally nested in the member states and the geography of the member states, but recognize that it's a that it's a global diplomatic environment, and thus the sphere, the area of interest deep into Africa to the west and east of the alliance, all are important to take into account in how we plan, how we think, how we consider deterrence. So if I just a little bit of context, you talked about, and we use terms like gray zone and hybrid tactics, and how challenging that is to consider from a deterrence point of view. I would start with these tactics, these various methods, terror groups, proxies, non-state actors, and alongside Russia and other powerful state actors like China, they all are doing things that impact on the alliance security and welfare. We look at horrible terrorist attacks in Belgium at the airport as just an example where, you know, over 100 Belgian citizens were killed. And it's not that long ago. These are not, these types of activities have the potential to be pushed and forgotten in the past, but they occur at such a regularity in terms of terrorist activities. But when we look at every electoral cycle, every economic cycle, we see an evolution of the type of hybrid tactics that either are attributed to state activity or are recognized as being performed by proxies. And I could use the example of Russian mafia engagements against the state of Estonia in April of 2007, where for a variety of reasons, purportedly because a statue was moved that had Soviet lineage to it, that the country was near shut for a solid month and a bit. You know, these types of, don't forget who is running your information technology infrastructure, kind of a message can be sent. And sure, it's done by a proxy, but when you, in some cases, you look at the military presence of 15 to 30,000 troops in Georgia, occupying South Ossetia and other regions, you see the move by the Russian Federation to recognize South Ossetia as Alania, a nod towards the medieval kingdom of Alania, I presume, in the North Caucasus, and how that de facto president could make agreements to join the Russian Federation, how that could bring to a head. You institute a conflict, you freeze a conflict, you wait a certain number of years while the international community moves on to other pressing matters, and then you cause another action like we're seeing potentially the break of a couple of provinces, breakaway provinces of Georgia, to join the Russian Federation, or essentially be taken and reforming borders. We all are seeing the state espionage activity. You could pick a topic for disinformation that we have seen, of course, the 2016 U.S. election, the 2017 French election, where information related to President Macron was made public, these kind of acts to destabilize our democratic institutions. So we know that all of these types of activities happen. And how does an alliance, a political military alliance like NATO, who arguably was tooled and designed in the beginning, understandably, to deal with a major kinetic war and to prevent thermonuclear war, how does it respond to these feints and jabs, to these different types of tactics? I don't want to be simplistic about it. So I think we could imagine if the alliance could think like a global or like a single diplomatic entity and not just a collection of 30 political sovereign states, be prepared to attribute collectively to have diplomatic weight. Be prepared to isolate on incidents of concern, not globally, not generally, but isolate on incidents of concern and use the full power of the member states in a variety of ways. Please go back to my point. There is space for the NATO and the EU. They do not have to compete as how they act. But you see how the alliance can bring, using the NATO-Russia Council, using other forum, these types of energies and powers to bear on potential adversaries. And we need a new model for managing hybrid. We need an advanced and open political and military discussion on how to deal with these threats. And it will require concessions, Dave, from the military, who simplistically looks for clarity and predictability, and really from a political level as well, there will need to be other types of flexibilities to allow a scheme of maneuver for the military to take action and for member states to be able to consider what their key foreign policy interests are that would align to create in a limited number of areas, a recognition that NATO can speak for the alliance. That doesn't mean that an ally can't have a different opinion and maybe even express that different opinion, but allow the alliance and the power and the weight of the alliance to carry strong messages in a public way. And that's a tough space, because there are a number of allies who, from their own foreign policy point of view, would be very uncomfortable with the idea that the alliance could speak for them, could attribute for them. But, and I'll finish with this, Dave, the speed of response, the complexity of the types of problems that are being brought from and forward. NATO is already a diplomatic entity, but it needs to embrace a more global persona in how it deals with these challenges, including with other emerging actors like China, who, you know, NATO's not going to go to China, but China and its investments and its activities are coming to NATO.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
So, because the involvement of the alliance, potentially or not, in the Pacific is something that kind of I find interesting and comes up periodically. When you say that NATO won't go to China, I mean, is that driven by the fact that it still remains North Atlantic focused? I mean, because the western border of the alliance is on the Pacific, which is inextricably, as you know from your naval career, tied into that part of the world. But is it, and I've heard in the last year or so, increasing mention about what the alliance needs to do to kind of get its head around China, which is having an increasingly global role and focus. So when you say the alliance won't go to China, do you mean that in the sense of the regional involvement, or is you more talking about what China's doing in some of those different areas, things like investing in strategic ports in Europe and that kind of activity? So what does it mean to go or not go to that part of the world, I guess, in the current context?
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, In my, you know, simple sailor sort of expression here, the NATO area of responsibility ends at the eastern seaboard of Canada and the United States and includes Europe. And that's a function of the understandable perspective of how the alliance was created in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Now, that said, it's also clear that NATO has conducted operations in Afghanistan and in an ISAF format on request from the United Nations, and has conducted operations in stabilization activities in North Africa and the like, right? So it is not so binary that NATO does not conduct operations outside of its AOR. Of course, it does. And it has interests that extend well beyond the area of responsibility, which is really just a military command and control mechanism. What is also true is that member states have assets and island responsibilities that are outside of the North Atlantic, including in other parts of the world in Asia Pacific. So an attack on any one of the allies represents an attack on NATO. And one could imagine that responsibilities, that an argument would be made, an Article 4 consultation would occur, and perhaps an Article 5 decision made, that an attack on Guam could represent an attack on the United States, and therefore the alliance would be required to respond. So let's just park all of that to say that anywhere that an ally has responsibilities has the potential to involve the alliance. Now, what in practical terms, it's how you concluded with China. China is making investments in Djibouti, is making investments in port, in a strategic port infrastructure in Europe and otherwise, which has the potential to be of interest to the alliance in a way that will value the alliance engaging proactively with China to make sure that there's just a common understanding of our individual interests and to identify those shared interests that we might have so that we can work together on a variety of things, including, you know, in Africa and peace and stability in Africa. It's fair to say that the foreign policy structure of the Communist China Party and the weight and normal intentions of member states of the alliance, there is not complete alignment there. And so as a function of that, the non-interference approach that China more commonly is seen to take in its engagements internationally, that might not necessarily align completely with the values-based approach that members of the alliance take. But there still could be common ground, and we still need to continue to engage. But there, I think the practical reality is the alliance is not looking to enlarge, not looking to force a sphere of activity and effort outside its boundaries, other than in its own defense as a self-defense alliance. But it is true that China's global growth, its increasing influence for a variety of reasons, and its acquisitions and military posture in moving towards the alliance is seeing China becoming more an actor that the alliance speaks about.
The last piece that you wanted to touch on in terms of the different capability fits within the alliance and how that all kind of fits together going forward. In one of your last jobs before you went over to Brussels, you had to deal with the various tribes and factional parties within the Canadian Armed Forces to try and help divvy up a relatively finite pool of funding to actually get the biggest bang for the Canadian Armed Forces collective buck. I don't know how much of an insight you got during your time in Brussels into how other countries do it, but I would suppose that it's not entirely dissimilar to the way that it happens in Canada. So aggregating out those different inter-military, international military tribal bun fights, what kind of perspective do you have on how the alliance as a whole goes about that organization with the intent of trying to produce the different types of outputs, some of which you touched on, that are needed to make sure that you don't actually have to ever use the military, because if somebody believes that you've got a credible force that could be put in place, but as you've touched on in different ways, that's difficult across many different alliances, some of whom have very different military cultural histories. So how does that all knit together at an alliance level?
Yeah, and that really, I think, is kind of the third idea that I would share. I think that the first, of course, being that we, the alliance, need to be capable at deterring. And to do that, we need to recognize the hybrid environment and to be a global diplomatic entity that's able to do that. And then it's what's the stuff that we need to have to be able to do that, which is essentially the capabilities that the alliance has and needs to develop moving forward. So that, you know, what context would I offer to start with? First, NATO is a pretty sophisticated alliance, but at the same point in time, it's pretty asymmetric in the allied country situations. There's a near numerical mix of pre-Cold War's allies and post-Cold War joining allies. When you consider that many will buy a ship or an aircraft and operate it for decades, even though some allies joined in the 90s, they're still operating MiG aircraft alongside Western developed technology, to just use a simple example. So there's opportunities and challenges that come there. One, the opportunities, we have that deep insight that we talked about how actors in the Russian Federation would consider either operationally or tactically do things. And there are challenges also in the mix of that Western and non-Western technology. Like, what type of ammunition do you use, as an example? Something simple like that. Fuel. What type of fuel do you actually need to use for all your variety of vehicles? And then there's like a real asymmetry, Dave, in the size and capabilities amongst allies. You have some allies whose military is as large as the population of an ally inside the alliance. And because of that, how do we have a structure in the alliance that allows everyone to play a fair role and plug in an effective and fair way? Well, the process that's been in place for many, many years now, really since, in essence, the alliance was formed, is a NATO defense planning process, which has a cycle. It's a multi-year cycle, a four-year cycle, where you go through, and it's very thoughtful in its structure. You know, there's what's the political ambition. You then think about, well, what are the types of bad situations we would have to deal with? What type of capabilities do we have? Do we need to deal with that? How many of those different capabilities, armored vehicles, aircraft, et cetera, do we need to have to deal with that? And how many do we have? Then how many do we need to get? And then we'll apportion those out, kind of simplistically said. It's very mechanical. It's an enormous exam question, truly, with many, 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 many variables, but it is very mechanical. And it is one slow crank of the wheel preceding a very long lead time delivery of military capabilities, which, you know, you've reported on for many years. So ACT has kind of a driving role. And what do I think about where this space could go? There are examples in the alliance of joint capability ventures, strategic lift in the C-17 flight run by five or six allies, where each one gets a certain percentage and number of hours that they can run based on their contributions. And they're able to use that for national as well as allied reasons. So, okay, but there are models in place. There are STANAG, standing NATO agreements, which define how a radio needs to be built so that it can talk to all the other NATO radios. Those are like the leading edge, but they're decades old and they're still necessary, but we need a STANAG next. We need a new way to think about capability development that is not just about telling everyone, this is the attributes. This is how big the door needs to be. You can go build your own vehicle. As long as the door is this big, it's perfect. I think the example where we've seen countries collaborate in formations, such as the German-Netherlands Armored Corps, we need to have collaborative development of capabilities by allies, by groups of allies. If you have five or six smaller allies who pool their resources and their intent, they are able to acquire more agile, more depth, different types of capabilities than they would remotely be able to do on their own. Now, let's be clear, right? I'm talking, and some would say pie in the sky, perhaps, about the ignoring the politics of the investment of the defense industrial benefit of the, well, you're not telling a small military that it can't have certain capabilities because it's got to invest all in some things. Clearly, smaller countries like Montenegro need to have certain ability to support their civilian authorities. And so they can't contribute to just one helicopter capability and that's all they do. But there is a lot of scope to have allies together, probably in a two-track methodology, to be honest, Dave, where there are primary, you know, that kind of steady crank of the wheel, because a logistics vehicle is a logistics vehicle and you can operate it for 15 to 20 years and you can have that slow identified because that's not going to change. But we need an accelerated track because our capability determination through the NATO defense planning process and delivery through individual country acquisition processes is too slow. Too slow in the cyber, obviously, realm, in our ability to do countermeasures against electronic warfare systems that we saw Russia use so effectively against the Ukraine that are very illuminating and very concerning about what we need to do. And then if we look at some of the recent announcements by the Russian Federation about more advanced weapons designs that are in place, what are we doing to counter those from a ballistic missile defense capability point of view, et cetera? And so we need to accelerate. We need tracks that are not just this primary one crank of the wheel track. And we need to see the agencies, the NSPA and the NCIA, perhaps undertake an evolution of their mandate to help them drive with allies common capability development. And if we find a way, the alliance finds a way to further the integration of capability design and management, that will that includes a steady state sort of deliberate track and a much more responsive track with the agencies well positioned by mandate to drive the way through common funding and through discrete funding by countries who will participate in certain capability acquisitions, the alliance will be in a much better place to support its deterrence needs.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Darren, to share that perspective that you're bringing, having just stepped out of your job in Brussels. The last question I'll ask is, now that you're retired from the Canadian Armed Forces and have a little bit more time on your hands, what are you reading?
Well, I'm working on a couple of things. I'm halfway through an interesting book by Dan Heath called Upstream, which really is the idea is, how can you think about problems and solve problems upstream before they happen, or to significantly mitigate a problem that you see happening by changing something that's left in time of the issue? So it's a really interesting book. And the other is by a fellow named Laney on infonomics and how you kind of monetize, manage, and measure information as an asset in and of itself. And it's one of the earlier pieces about that's helping me frame the idea around big data and how we can use that to increasingly better effect.
Great. Thanks again for joining us today on Defense Deconstructed. Great to get your perspective.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producers, Charlotte Duval-Antoine and Drew Phillips, for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.